On today's episode of Locked Up with History, we're looking at the story of the MacGyver private gold escort robbery and the execution of three of the men. But how did the body of one of the men end up in the front window of a Melbourne shop? Stay tuned.
Warning. This podcast contains discussions of some potentially distressing topics. Listeners, please be advised. Come with us for true and tall tales unsurpassed, with stories from Victoria's dark colonial past. Spirits, executions, ghosts, murders and ghouls. These are the stories they don't teach you at school. All these twisted tales of mystique and mystery coming to you now on Locked Up With History.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Locked Up With History, Season 3, Episode 1. And my name is Deb Robinson, and we've had a long hiatus between episodes, and I do apologise for that. I have been rather busy, though. We have been writing a chapter for a book that is about to come out named The Hunt for the Australian Ripper. I was very privileged to be asked to write a chapter on Frederick Deeming, my favourite serial killer, and I will be doing a podcast on him a little bit later in the year. And I'll put all the details of the book when it comes out up on the Locked Up With History website as well. But back to today's episode, we're going to explore the story of the MacGyver private gold escort robbery in 1853 that led to the execution of three men at the Melbourne jail. The accounts of those involved in this robbery and who exactly was involved do change and vary depending on whose version you listen to. For this reason, sometimes it's difficult to get to the truth of what exactly went on. People by their very nature will change events and their part in it, especially if it's to save their own skin. But before we get to this story, we need to set the background of what was happening in Victoria at the time of the gold rushes and what exactly was a gold escort. Gold had been found on and off for decades in Australia before the first credited finding of mineable gold by Edward Hargraves at a waterhole in Ophir, New South Wales, near Bathurst, on the 12th of February 1851. And apologies for my pronunciation, as I've said before, I'm not great on pronunciations. It was an exciting find, and the papers were full of stories of the Californian gold rushes of just a few years previously, especially stories of ordinary men becoming rich quickly and changing their lives for the better. Now, here in Victoria, the first gold was found a few months later, on the 1st of July 1851, by James Esmond at Creswick Creek near Clunes. It was the first marketable goldfield in Victoria. A reward of £200 was posted by the Victorian government in 1851 for the discovery of gold within 200 miles of Melbourne. Within 6 months, gold had been discovered in Clunes, Ballarat, Bendigo and Castlemaine. By 1852, 370,000 immigrants had arrived in Australia, with many seeking their fortunes on the goldfields of Victoria. And it was a fortune for many, with a third of the world's gold accounted for on the Victorian goldfields in the 1850s. But while many men toiled very hard for their profits, there were others who sought to capitalise on others' fortunes. The process of exchanging the gold into money was a complicated process for the miners and required the precious metal to be taken to the treasury in Melbourne, where they would receive the best prices for their hard work. Initially, gold was sent to Melbourne with the mail runs, but as the amount of gold increased, this became too dangerous and government-run gold escorts were set up. The first gold escort ran between Ballarat and Melbourne in September 1851, with another from Mount Alexander a month later. There were also escorts that ran to Geelong. Between March 1852 and December 1853, a gold escort ran between Forest Creek and Adelaide with 18 runs under the authority of Sub-Inspector of Police Alexander Tolmer. Gold sent to Melbourne with the gold escorts cost the miners a shilling per ounce to transport. From here, it was sent to England. Miners were then able to claim their deposits by providing a receipt describing their gold and proving their identity. If they were unable to do so, the government claimed the money. It was a constant source of bitterness for the miners as they had not only had to pay for the transport, but there was no compensation if the gold did not reach Melbourne for whatever reason. Private gold escorts became popular among the miners as they provided insurance against loss. Early in 1852, Dyett's Private Gold Escort Company was established with 12 men, followed in June 1852 by the formation of the Melbourne and Mount Alexander Escort Company. But to the bushrangers, gold escorts, regardless of if they were government-run or private affairs, were a logical target for a quick fortune. Escorts between the diggings and major towns made easy targets, as well as creating opportunities for some of the more spectacular gold thefts, such as the heist of the 30,000-pound gold bound for England from the ship Nelson at Williamstown. The gold escorts in the dense Victorian bush would set the scene for the MacIver private gold escort robbery in July 1853.
If you'd like to visit some of the places featured on Locked Up With History, book in a tour with Twisted History. For the full range of tours and to book, visit twistedhistory.net.au.
It was from this goldfield on the 20th of July 1853 that the MacIver Private Gold Escort left the diggings, heading to connect with the Bendigo Escort run to Melbourne at Kyneton. The escort left around 9 a.m. from the diggings under the charge of Superintendent Robert Warner. Also on the escort were Sergeant George Dewins, Driver James Fuchs, Troopers Samuel Bencham Davis, David Bestwater, although this surname has many variations, and John Morton. The escort was carrying around 2,223 ounces of gold, valued at the time at £8,000. In addition, was £700 in used banknotes, with all the gold and notes secured in two black strong boxes. A worthwhile prize for any bushranger who dared to try and capture it. The escort was heavily armed, with the troopers all carrying a sword, carbine and pistols. Warner and Dewins also carried six-barrelled revolvers. Only the cart driver, Fuchs, was unarmed. Earlier that day, John Francis, his brother George and Joe Gray left the MacIver diggings heading to the Mia Mia Inn to meet up with George Melville, William Atkins and George Wilson. The men unsaddled their horses and, armed with weapons, headed up the road to meet the gold escort. The bushrangers cut down branches and placed them across the track to provide a screen for two of the men, with the remainder hidden about 30 yards further up the track. Their chosen spot was on an uphill slope near a sharp bend in the track. Dewins was riding ahead of the cart as the escort travelled the road to the Mia Mia Inn and further beyond to Kyneton. The group was 6 kilometres northeast of the inn and 10 kilometres from the diggings when they noted the barricade across the road. Dewins immediately called halt to investigate, but at the same time, several armed bushrangers appeared from behind the bushes and immediately opened fire on the escort with a hail of bullets. There was later a dispute as to who fired the first shot, with the escort maintaining the robbers fired the first shot, while the bushranger said the escort fired the first shot at the men behind the trees. Regardless, the hail of bullets had the desired effect. The troopers and the driver all fell immediately, seriously wounded. Trooper Morton received a ball in the shoulder. Trooper Davis was shot in the cheek. Trooper Bestwater caught a ball in the leg and dislocated his arm. And Driver Fuchs was shot in the knee with another bullet grazing his temple. John Francis testified later that the bushrangers had not wanted to take human life, that they expected to steal the gold without a shot being fired. Dewan's horse received 2 bullet wounds, which made the horse bolt through the barricade of the bushrangers, and he raced to the government camp 3 miles away to raise the alarm. Dewan's later identified Wilson as one of the robbers who had taken aim at him. The bushrangers kept everyone at bay while they relieved the cart of its 2 strongboxes. Superintendent Warner kept watch on the bushrangers as he was uninjured. He followed them into the bush until they saw him and fired at him, at which time Warner retreated to Patterson Station to get assistance. News of the attack spread like wildfire, and it wasn't long before Dewins returned to the scene with reinforcement troopers and several miners, all armed and furnished with horses. More diggers, totalling around 400, turned out to scour the bush in all directions in the hope of securing one of the robbers. In the meantime, the bushrangers headed into the bush, removing the gold from the strongboxes and reloaded their guns. After hearing shots fired in the distance, the men headed into the bush of the Tiers Ranges and spent the night by the river on the Mollison's Run. The following morning, the 6 men, John Francis, George Francis, George Wilson, George Melville, William Atkins and Joe Gray, divided the gold between them and headed to Melbourne. They headed first to Kilmore and then to the rocky waterholes, now known as Kalkallo, where the gang threw away their weapons and divided into two groups to head into Melbourne. In the days after the robbery, suspicions and rumours ran high, with many stories proven to be false, including the death of Trooper Morton and that Francis Christie, aka Captain Melville, had been captured and was the ringleader. A hefty reward of £500 for the capture and conviction of the culprits was posted by the private escort company.
For a fascinating look at life in a colonial prison, visit Geelong Jail Museum. Situated just over an hour from Melbourne in the heart of Geelong, it's Victoria's most intact and longest continually operating colonial prison. For information, search for Geelong Jail or call 1300 865 800.
The first break in the case came fairly quickly, in fact, the same afternoon as the robbery. Around 2 p.m, Jay Tucker was working as a detective when the report reached the office about the escort robbery. At the same time, a young man living at the MacGyver Diggings called in to report that a Colt revolver had been stolen from his tent and he suspected the man in the tent next to his. After securing a search warrant, authorities searched the tent that had been pointed out and discovered that the man was long gone. But what was left behind turned out to be crucial evidence in the escort robbery. On the floor of the tent was a map of the ship Madagascar, which was currently anchored in Hobson's Bay, preparing for departure to England in the coming weeks. On the map was also written J. Francis, cabin passenger. Back in Melbourne, the two groups of bushrangers headed towards the Francis residence in Collingwood, with the Francis brothers and Joe Gray arriving around 11 p.m. on Sunday night, with Wilson and Atkins arriving a couple of hours before them. Melville had headed to his own house in Little Bourke Street. Joe Gray said he was heading to Adelaide. The Francis brothers and George Wilson had purchased passages to England on the Madagascar. George Melville and his wife had purchased passages to Mauritius aboard the Kalooni, while the Atkins were planning on heading to Sydney. On the 10th of August 1853, Detective Constable Hindle Thompson and Constable Alexander Eason boarded the Madagascar in Hobson's Bay with a warrant to arrest John Francis and his brother George Francis for the stolen revolver and a Bowie knife. George Francis was not on board at the time, but his brother John was. The cabins were searched, but Francis had enough time to ask Wilson to remove the gold from his brother's cabin, thinking they were looking for the proceeds of the escort robbery. Francis was arrested for the stolen revolver and taken into custody. On the trip to shore, Francis asked permission to pull up to the ship Kalooni, where Melville was, and to ask him to take care of his wife. His brother George was arrested on shore, and both men were brought before the courts on the charges of the stolen gun and knife. They were both discharged for lack of evidence, but the two men were rearrested as suspects in the escort robbery. On August 11th, there were two lots of police that searched both Madagascar, again, and the Kalooni, both ships moored in Hobson's Bay. Detective Ashley, Detective Murray and Sergeant Sincock boarded the Kalooni and found a leathern trunk in one of the cabins containing two parcels of sovereigns with just over £1,123 in them, along with assorted papers and receipts in the name of George Melville. Melville was not on board at the time. Meanwhile, on the Madagascar, Constable Hindle Thompson arrested George Wilson, taking possession of a pair of trousers and a total of £358 in sovereigns. The next day, Captain McMahon, the Chief Inspector of Police, sent for George Francis from the Swanston Street Watch House to have a private chat. McMahon pointed out that the notice posted on the gates, saying that one party concerned in the escort robbery would receive a passage out of the colony and £500 if he consented to being an improver or an informer. After considerable hesitation, George Francis agreed. Detective Ashley made two more arrests on the same day with George Melville, arrested in the North Star Hotel, and found in possession of £100 in gold, silver and notes, a silver watch, six-barreled revolver and an American dollar. Melville was taken to the watch house. The other arrest was that of William Atkins and his wife Agnes at a house in Little Bourke Street. Detective Ashley and George Francis entered the house and Francis identified Atkins as one of the robbers. They found £3 and a bank draft for £400 on him. Mrs. Atkins was found with £81 on her person and insisted she had nothing more. After a private chat with Agnes, Frances told Detective Ashley that Agnes had another bank draft hidden in the hem of one of her dresses. It was soon located and was for £700 in Agnes's maiden name of McLaughlin. On August 13th, Detective Ashley and Sergeant Simcock and Detective Murray, and accompanied by the approver George Francis, headed to the McIver diggings with warrants to arrest Robert Harding, Edward McAvoy, George Shepherd, a.k.a. Ruggy, and George Elston. The men arrived at the diggings on the 15th of August to find the men had moved to the Goulburn diggings. Two of the wives remained, so instructions were left with Armstrong, who was in charge of the McIver police, to arrest the men if they returned while the party headed to the Goulburn diggings. On Wednesday, 17th of August, the police sent Francis out to look for the men, believing that the police would be too inconspicuous and would alert the men to their presence. Instead, George did a runner. Back in Melbourne in the district court, there were 11 people brought up on charges of being involved with the escort robbery. Most of them were dismissed with no tangible evidence, but the Francis brothers, George Melville, William and Agnes Atkins, were held on remand for a week. On the 18th of August, Ashley, Simcock and Murray headed out and arrested Shepherd and Elston within an hour. The two men had returned to McIver, where they were arrested by Armstrong on entering their wives' tents. An alert for Francis was also sent out and he was recaptured near the McIver goldfields. All four men, plus Francis, were taken back to Melbourne to go before the courts. The group reached the Rocky Waterholes on Monday night, and George Francis, who was handcuffed for greater security, was removed from the watch house and instead spent the night in the house of Robert Small, who was the watch house keeper. Around 9 a.m. the following morning, Francis asked to go to the bathroom and was escorted by Trooper Thomas Cox. He asked the trooper to remove his braces before entering the privy. After a few moments, Cox heard a horrible gargling noise and on pushing open the door, discovered Francis on the floor with a gash across his throat from a razor. Colonel Anderson tried to take any last words from Francis, but he was incapable of speech and passed away within 10 minutes of the deed. The razor was later identified as belonging to the watch house keeper and was in the room where Francis was kept overnight.
You're listening to Locked Up With History.
There were several prisoners brought before the District Police Court on August 25th for examination. These were George Elston, Robert Harding, Edward McAvoy, George Wilson, George Melville, William Atkins and his wife Agnes. The men were all brought up in handcuffs, which had the defence lawyer Mr. Reed stating that it was a violation of British constitutional law, that the accused should be allowed to come up free in man and body, and he hoped that the bench would not permit such a violation of what was the privilege of every man previous to conviction. Mr. Reed then complained he had not been able to speak to the prisoners, which was granted. John Francis appeared as an approver in the place of his brother and gave evidence against all of the men. He was greeted by dark and bitter scowls of hate from the prisoners at the bar who stood accused of the robbery. At the end of the testimony, Elston, Harding and McAvoy were remanded for 1 week on the request of Captain McMahon after receiving information that Joe Gray may have been captured on horse-stealing charges in Portland, which needed to be investigated. No further record is found for George Elston, Robert Harding and Edward McAvoy, along with Agnes Atkins, so we assumed that they were all discharged with no convictions. George Melville, William Atkins and George Wilson were not so lucky and were remanded to a higher court to hear the charges brought against them. The trial took place on September 17th in the Melbourne Supreme Court before Justice Williams. The day before, the counsel for the three men all made a request that some of the money taken by police should be released to pay for their defence. The judge allowed for the release of £40 per man, despite the Crown prosecutor objecting on the grounds it was not known if the money was proceeds from the robbery. George Melville, William Atkins and George Wilson were placed on trial for the serious crime of robbing the gold escort on July 20th. Specifically, there were three charges against the men. The first, that they had assaulted Thomas Fuchs, putting him in fear of his life and taking away 1,000 ounces of gold, the property of William Lasouf and others. Secondly, that they had stolen 1,000 ounces of gold, the property of Robert Warner. And thirdly, that they had stolen 1,000 ounces of gold, the property of Robert Mariner. The men all pleaded not guilty. Melville was represented by Archibald Michie, later Attorney General and became the first Queen's Counsel of Victoria. Atkins was represented by Thomas Fellows, later Solicitor General and Judge, and Wilson by Richard Ireland, later Attorney General and Solicitor General. The crowds wanting to see the escort robbers were extremely large, with newspapers describing them as filling the court to almost suffocation, including the approaches outside. The court heard much of the same testimony from 12 p.m. until around 8:20 p.m. Then Justice Williams began his summing up. Justice Williams stated he did not regret the time taken on the case, as it was one of extreme importance and demanded the strictest inquiry. Justice Williams took care to make the jury understand that it was the law and not the jury responsible for the outcome of their verdicts. He said, "The law had laid down certain punishments for certain offences, and if the jury found the men guilty in this case, then it was not the jury taking away the lives of the three men, but the law of the land, and they were not responsible for the consequences following the verdict being handed down. And no matter how painful these duties might be, they must be discharged as a matter of duty to the public and their country." The jury retired for 40 minutes before returning a guilty verdict on the first count and not guilty on the other two charges. Mr. Fellows asked for the verdict to be set aside on an Act of Parliament as to whether there was evidence to show the gold had ever been in the possession of Mr. Lesouf, and if there wasn't, then there was no evidence for the charge. Justice Williams conferred with Justice Redmond Barry over the next 24 hours, but it was decided that there was nothing in the point made to delay the sentencing. The three men asked if there was any reason that the sentence of the court should not be imposed on them. Wilson requested to have a witness say a word for him, but was reminded that the time for that had passed. Melville stated that he was placed in as painful position as any human could be placed, that he was a persecuted and innocent man, that several witnesses had sworn falsely against them on many points, and as this was the last time he would have an opportunity to speak, he wished for the truth to be known. Justice Williams reminded Melville that the time had now passed and that the verdict could not be set aside. Melville said he did not wish for mercy. He would appeal to a higher court at whose tribunal judges themselves would be judged, a tribunal before which he hoped he would soon stand and be found more spotless than the verdict of the jury would allow him to appear in the eyes of the world. He was going to his death on the false swearing of the bloodthirsty Francis, upon whom the vengeance of God would fall for what he had done. The judge, during his summing up, recommended that all men should be at peace, to which Melville replied, "May God Almighty forgive me as freely as I forgive Francis." Justice Williams then donned the black cap and passed the sentence of death. The execution was set down for the 3rd of October 1853 at 8 a.m. at the Melbourne jail. The three men had been attended by Reverend G. Studdett since their condemnation. The men had spoken at length but made no confessions, yet admitted to living bad lives. Melville's and Atkins' wives had visited frequently. The night before the execution, the men slept soundly, waking between 4 and 5 a.m. and dressed themselves with particular attention to their appearance. They spent the early hours in listening to the teachings of Reverend Studdett. At 8 a.m, the High Sheriff announced the hour had arrived. George Melville was the first to leave the cell, dressed in a black surcoat, white waistcoat and trousers, appearing pale and nervous. He was immediately pinioned by the hangman Walsh and had the white cap placed on his head. Next was George Wilson, who was dressed in a white linen coat and trousers with a black waistcoat. Wilson begged to be allowed to speak, but no one was able to hear what he said. Finally was William Atkins, who was dressed in a rough brown coat, grey waistcoat and trousers. He had nothing to say as he was pinioned with the other two men. Reverend Studdett read the Church of England burial service as the men were walked outside to the yard where the gallows had been erected, and a large crowd waited on them. It was the largest crowd that had been seen at an execution up until that point. The men ascended the scaffold, and Melville attempted some last words, but realised that the crowd was unable to hear him and became silent and wished the crowd a good morning. Wilson addressed the crowd and spoke again of the evidence against the men. When finished, the hangman Walsh drew their caps down, placed the ropes around their neck, and descended the stairs. The executioner then drew the fatal bolt, and the men fell and convulsed in the throes of a death struggle. Atkins died immediately, but Wilson and Melville died hard. The executioner needed to pull on Melville's legs forcefully, and he soon ceased to move. After the appropriate time, the bodies were cut down. Interested in learning more about this episode? Join us on the Locked Up With History Facebook page for more facts and discussions about the dark colonial past of Victoria and beyond. Now, you might think that the death of George Melville, George Wilson and William Atkins was the end of our story of the escort robbery, but not so. Agnes Atkins, the wife of William, was left destitute after the death of her husband and near the end of her pregnancy. A collection was taken up which allowed her to return to Sydney and her extended family. John Francis was given a passage out of the colony with his wife Elizabeth and headed to America before returning to England, where his wife deserted him and John then returned to Australia alone. The Madagascar, the ship that was to be the escape route for the Francis brothers and George Wilson, left for his voyage to England, but 6 months later, still had not arrived. There were rumours of a leaky ship landing at Rio, but no more was heard of her after that. The bodies of William Atkins and George Wilson were buried the same day as their execution in the pauper section of the Melbourne Cemetery. But George Melville's body had a more exciting route to the cemetery, which leads us back to the title of this episode, The Body in the Window. His wife, Alphacene, applied for her husband's body after his execution, and it was agreed to. Alphacene took George's body back to her shop in Little Bourke Street, where he was placed on a chair in the front window and decorated with flowers and streamers. Alphacene then charged people half a crown to entertain them with the torrent of abuse towards the police force and the treatment of her beloved husband. More than 2,000 people filled the street to view the dead bushranger on display in the shop front window. Authorities moved quickly to reclaim the body of George Melville, and he was buried in the Melbourne Cemetery the following day with no more fanfare. There was such an uproar over the display of George Melville's body in the oyster shop window that authorities moved quickly to change the law and how the bodies of the condemned were handled. It was the last time that a body would be handed back to the family for burial, although it was 1865 before the law came into effect legally. In that year, the law relating to the execution of prisoners and Section 315 of the Criminal Law and Practice Statute was amended to require the body of every person executed for murder shall be buried within the precincts of the jail in which they shall have been last confined after conviction. Now, before we wrap up the story on the MacIver Gold Escort robbery, don't forget to check out our webpage at lockedupwithhistory.com.au, where you can find all of the previous episodes, along with some of the photos for the episodes when we have them. And of course, you can also listen to the episodes on your favourite podcast streaming platform. If you have any questions or like to discuss any of the episodes, you can join us over on Facebook in either the Locked Up With History group or the brand new Locked Up With History Facebook page. This is where you can ask me any questions on the current episodes and where you can view any of the media associated with the episodes as well. And if you have a suggestion for a story or might like to hear a podcast on, please feel free to send us a message in the group or to one of our emails and we will certainly consider it. On our next episode, we'll be looking at the story of Owen McQueenie, one of the men executed at Geelong Jail, who had two different coloured eyes. He was executed for the murder of a single mother, Elizabeth Lowe, just outside of Meredith in 1858, in a case that became known as the Green Tent Murder. Until then, see you on the darker side of history.
More information on the story from today's episode, check out the show notes or join the Locked Up With History Facebook group. Remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.